So, with that type of background, what then motivated you to get into public service? And how did the US's unconditional support for the Israeli government shift your perspective on public service? And how are you looking to serve now?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right in that. My studies, my time in college was very social justice oriented, and I was motivated to join public service because I really believed and still believe that public policy can be a vehicle for progress and, more importantly, justice. As a Muslim American, I saw firsthand, and as a person of color, I saw firsthand the impact of marginalization and oppression on communities in the country. Just in terms of like what led me to really get involved, working for elected officials, working for the Biden administration, I was someone who rallied my community to support President Biden in 2020, and obviously served as a political appointee in the administration, someone there to advance the agenda of this specific administration. That was because it touted the administration touted this idea of achieving justice for marginalized communities, and we're having a staff that reflects the diversity of the country. I think over time I recognized that that diversity is not being utilized in a meaningful way. It's the Biden administration is the administration with the most Muslim appointees, and the campaign worked or was built on a promise to really right the wrongs committed against Arab Americans. And I think that all of that was washed away when it came down to this unconditional support of Israel while they're committing mass atrocities in Gaza. I think I just came to realize that in terms of public service, it doesn't matter if the administration has the most Muslim appointees or it has an incredibly diverse staff, if they are not listening to diverse voices, if they are not if they just continue to uphold a harmful status quo, that to me is not really utilizing diversity in any meaningful way. And I think that through the administration's actions, it's become clear to me that no amount of Muslims serving in the administration change the harmful foreign policy unless the leaders are willing to change the harmful foreign policy and listen to those voices. I think what I realized is that I don't want to just be a Muslim in a public service position for the sake of being a Muslim in a public service position. I want my perspective and my background and the fact that I'm representation for Muslim communities in the country to truly be considered. And I want the same for other Muslim public service officials as well. And what I've seen so far is that the administration has not done that. I would hope, in my future, I think that that's really what I would aim and hope to have happen.
I think you hit the nail on the head where it's not enough just to put a seat at the table if you're not willing to ask your guests how they're doing or serve them a meal. Edward, why don't we throw it back to you and Hala, and we'll go two questions to two questions.
Absolutely. So before I do that, I want to note that, there's something you all can do about this. So just now, a few minutes ago, we posted an action alert on our website. You can use this action alert to send a message directly to the White House and the State Department, calling on them to uphold the law. As Hala will tell you in a moment, the law already requires the U.S. government to stop sending weapons to the Israeli government because it is violating human rights. It is starving the people of Gaza. It's blocking U.S. aid shipments. It is committing war crimes. So existing law already requires a freezing of all this military weapon we've sent. So right now, if you go to care.com, CAIR.com, you'll see on our homepage there, a link that you can click on to send a message to the White House and the State Department saying, look, I've heard what Hala and Miriam have said. It's not acceptable. Please, you got to stop sending the weapons. You've got to uphold the law. So please take a moment to do that while we continue the conversation. CAIR.com, CAIR.com. We'll try to put the link in the chat as well. Hala, let me bring it back to you while we do that. You know, you've talked a bit about how you observed Islamophobia, anti-Arab racism manifesting, you know, behind the scenes. You know, tell me more about how Muslim and Arab staffers were treated differently, simply because they were Muslim or Arab, behind the scenes of the State Department. And, you know, did you notice any change after October 7th versus before? Was this always the way Muslims and Arabs were treated at the State Department, or did something change over the past 10 months?
That's a very good question. Look, so I'll come to this with twofold, really. So for one, I have basically 20 years of experience in U.S. government, right? So I was a diplomat for 18 years. Before that, I worked on the Hill. Before that, I even interned with the State Department. I've gone through various administrations. I've gone through so many different policies, right? I can't speak about the State Department as a monolith. I'll talk about my experience. It has always been a place where we can be heard as diplomats. You're right. And we do so. I'm a political officer by training. That is what I did for the vast majority of my career. This last role was a public affairs role where I was actually the face of the U.S. government. But before that, I was working on human rights and affairs and writing cables back to the department. And no matter what the policies were, I was always able to contribute. That may not have always resulted in a massive policy shift, obviously, but within the State Department, the culture that I experienced was robust debate, robust conversation, welcomed back and forth. And I never faced a situation personally where there was fear for retaliation, there was silencing, there was self-censorship. For me personally, in the 18 years that I've served, this is the very first time. And something that was very, very stark to me was after I resigned, but before I resigned publicly, I resigned internally, right? And it became known that I was going to resign, but I still had a couple more or 3 weeks left within the State Department. So many diplomats reached out to me that were scared to discuss this issue. This is un-American, right? American diplomats should not be scared to speak to their colleagues. They reached out to me and expressed their concern. They reached out to me and expressed their concern that we were violating the law. They reached out to me and expressed their concern about the ongoing genocide and our violation of international law. They reached out and said, what can we do? We're scared for our own careers. Please speak out for us. This is not... If it was, I would have resigned much longer ago, right? So this is what has been so different at sort of the policy level, this whispering amongst each other and an inability to really feel comfortable. There were a lot of listening sessions initially. Those sort of dwindled off, but they were very frustrating because they were almost patronizing. It was obviously Arabs and Muslims, but not just Arabs and Muslims, to be quite frank, sort of diplomats across the board that were expressing concern. But it was more so, okay, get it out of your system and then do your job and don't question what you're doing. Again, I personally faced all of the harassment that I mentioned and I discussed. Another approach that the State Department was taking was, okay, you are no longer serving in the Middle East. You can't handle it. We'll send you to South America, or we'll send you to East Asia. Pack up your bags and let's go. And so that was another way that the State Department was dealing with the situation. And when I was going to resign, and this came from, I don't want to make it sound like it was malicious. It was actually goodwill, where other diplomats and senior diplomats wanted to retain me. They were offering me different positions, saying, please, you can't give up your 18-year career. This too shall pass. Please stay. But when it comes to a genocide, there's really no going back. And that was absolutely devastating to me. You know, colleagues, former colleagues that may be on this call know how much my career meant to me and how dedicated I was to the U.S. Foreign Service. And it was so heartbreaking to see what my country was doing, how we were in violation of our own laws, how we were obviously committing mass atrocities against the Palestinian people, but we were also not helping Israel in the long run, and we were absolutely destabilizing the Middle East to our own detriment. And I want to bring this back to U.S. national security, to our own detriment. But there was no room for that conversation within the State Department. And to me, really, that was unprecedented, both for Muslims and Arabs within the government, who almost were fearful of showing that, because as I saw someone wrote on this chat, we would be accused of being Hamas sympathizers, such nonsense to someone that had a top secret security clearance for over 18 years, who myself survived terrorist attacks against our own diplomatic mission in Yemen. You know, but there was this fear of, you speak up, you're going to be tarnished. You speak up, something will happen to your career. And again, I'll go back to, this is not the America that we should aspire to be, no matter what you believe in. This is not what the State Department should be either.
Paula, I wonder if you can tell us, you know, some we've discussed before, some of the specific examples you saw of not only Islamophobia, but anti-Arab racism. You told me a story a bit earlier about a really horrible remark about the pyramids that I thought was illuminating. And also you've noted that, you know, when you spoke up about this and you addressed, presented substantive concerns about whether or not the U.S. policy was violating the law, you know, you were dismissed and were told, well, this is just because you're an Arab or because you're a Muslim that you feel this way. So we're not going to take what you're saying seriously, right? You weren't arguing, listen, because I'm an Arab or a Muslim. You were saying, here's what the law is. Here's how you're violating the law. So tell us a bit about those experiences you had and about that pyramid story, because I think it's shocking. Please.
Yeah, I haven't said any of this publicly again, because I've wanted so much to focus on policy. But again, this issue of Islamophobia and anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian racism, I think, is driving so much of its policy. So I will share. In the various conversations that I had with other diplomats, with policymakers, again, so many goodwill diplomats trying to do everything they can to promote peace, to promote American interests in a way that is good for everyone involved and concerned. But there are some that are definitely promoting Islamophobia. And my issue is, okay, there are bad apples, no matter if you work in corporate, no matter if you work for the government. But when nothing is done about it, when those people are able to maintain positions of power, and particularly in the Middle East right now, the situation is so volatile, it's so dangerous. And when these type of people are allowed to continue to serve, are allowed to maintain their racism, that is why I'm discussing this now. So as you mentioned, one individual that I've had, and they're a representative of multiple individuals, just to be clear, kept on throughout the conflict showing drastic Islamophobic, racist sentiments. So one that Ahmed and Edward just referred to is, again, I worked with media, and we were in a group chat talking about particular Egyptian journalists, and this person was very frustrated with what was happening, and they said, I can't believe these people build the pyramids. How did these people build the pyramids, or something like that? It was very inappropriate, just very inappropriate rhetoric for someone that is supposed to be a diplomat, right? Again, this was one of the many things that I raised back to the department, and it was in writing. Nothing was done about it. And the story goes on and on at the micro level. One issue that really got to me was, I was giving a presentation to other diplomats, the point was, again, our messaging strategy, because that's the field that I worked in. And I had, I wanted to put up a picture of a Palestinian child that had died from starvation. And to think, I resigned back in April, that was a long time ago, and that was already happening then. And the point for me to put that in the presentation was, we need to understand what the Arab public is consuming. These are the traumatic images. that they're witnessing on a daily basis and they're blaming us for it, then you're going to put a U.S. official on Arab television and expect them to defend this policy when it is juxtaposed with literally a child that's skin and bones that has died from malnutrition and from a state of famine in the northern of Gaza at that time. I was lambasted. I was ridiculed. How could you put that image? It is absolutely inappropriate. And again, this goes back to the dehumanization of Palestinians, the almost, we out of sight, out of mind, we're going to pretend that this is not happening. We're going to maintain the status quo. We're going to maintain our policy, no matter, even if it is killing children, it isn't, even if it is killing babies. And that was accepted. That was permitted, which is, again, absolutely, absolutely unacceptable.
And how the person made this remark, how did these Egyptians ever build the pyramids? That person, without naming names, is still a high-ranking official in the State Department as we speak right now, correct?
I'll just say they've maintained their position, and it's definitely a position of influence, especially related to this policy. And I'll just leave it there.
Understood. And again, the State Department is aware of this because Hala filed a complaint about this before she left. So tonight, this is breaking news for them. They know, and yet that person is still there. And people like that can help explain why we have seen such horror unfold on our TV screens for 10 months. Robert, let me take you back to Miriam.
Sure. Yeah, just jumping right into it. Miriam, earlier you said representation matters, but it's not enough to hire impacted minorities, people of minority faiths, people of color, if they remain unheard or they continue to face discrimination or racism. From your time on Capitol Hill and then within the Biden administration, how did you perceive Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian racism shaping U.S. policy towards Gaza and just broader policies towards the Israeli occupation or their apartheid policies targeting Palestinians?
Yeah, so I was working on Capitol Hill during the time where I witnessed Representative Ilhan Omar get taken off the Foreign Affairs Committee for in the past criticizing the Israeli occupation and apartheid of Palestinians, and then also was there when Representative Rashida Tlaib got censured for showing support for the Palestine movement. So in really all the while these things were happening, Islamophobia has been on the rise, and anti-Arab racism has been on the rise since October. And there hasn't really even been any kind of like standalone resolutions or any solutions condemning this. And none of those things, you know, have garnered support from Congress. And while those examples may seem inconsequential to when it comes to policy, I think they're really indicative of this complete villainization of the Palestine movement, which has led to policies like defunding UNRWA and discrediting the Gaza death toll. And so I think that those policies, you know, indicate where our elected officials and people in power stand. And you know, I will say, like, of course, the non-Muslim, non-Arab allies in Congress have also faced, you know, wrongful criticism of their stances, but it's really only been the Muslim ones who have been penalized. And While I was in the administration, I witnessed the president and administration officials really spread this harmful rhetoric that showcased their own personal ideology and biases seeping into their handling of Israel-Palestine policy. And you know, one example being the president in a speech categorizing the Arabic word intifada as hate speech. And there was also a State Department official a spokesperson for State Department, Matt Miller, who had told protesters that they should tell Hamas to accept the ceasefire deal. and just things like that just kind of paint this really bad picture. And I think that it shows that the president and decision makers within the administration have the same ideology as Netanyahu, which Edward spoke to at the beginning. And I think that we should expect far more from our officials. And to me, it's clear that the administration and elected officials don't value Palestinian life the same way as non-Arab and non-Muslim life across the board, because if they did, they would not treat Palestinian death en masse as normal, which is clear that they do, because there's just been such a lack of significant action for 10 months now. And I think it's very easy for the United States to use its leverage to end the carnage in Gaza, and they haven't. And when we look at how easily the United States is able to strongly and immediately condemn war crimes and atrocities in Western nations, it's clear. It's really a clear indication that they dehumanize Arabs and Muslims in a way that we have seen throughout history. And so I think current U.S. policy and the current U.S. stance is really harmful to Palestinians in Gaza and in Palestine, but also Palestinians at home. I think that it's really emboldened and fueled hate crimes that we have seen take place over the past few months. And I think it's led to just a greater sense of discrimination, as Hala mentioned. We just saw it at the DNC last week when a Muslim Palestinian state representative, Rua, was not given the opportunity to speak and to give a vetted speech at the DNC. And I think that the administration really has a really major obligation to combat these hate crimes and discrimination in a far more meaningful way.
Thank you, Mariam. Thank you. So let's take some questions from the audience. Mariam, to you, someone said, look, we've witnessed 300 plus days of brutality against the Palestinian people, supported by our government, the Biden administration. Despite the student protests, the public protests, the resignations, the ICC arrest warrant pursuit, the ICJ ruling, condemnations by the UN, the press conferences from the political movements, the war crimes, the genocide still going on. So Mariam, question for you, is there something that people should be doing that has not been done to try to convince President Biden at this late date to change? Of course, someone who was a political appointee, worked in the administration, should people just keep doing what they're doing? Sign the action alert we put in the chat. Is there something more you think people should be doing?
Yeah, so I think that what people have done so far has led to some shift, albeit it's not a significant shift and it's not the shift that we need. Like I'll say the example of how many members of Congress boycotted Netanyahu's speech. It was far more than the first time or the time he previously came to Congress. So I think that that's indicative of public pressure working. But I think really the burden is placed on the administration and administration officials to meaningfully listen to these voices. I think if anything, it's to make our voices louder. I think I understand and have heard from others who, and Hala talked about it, who are, who are Muslim, who are Arab, who maybe feel some sense of fear of speaking out because of, the implications, the associations. But I think that, if we as Muslims, as Arabs, as just everyone in general, but I think Muslims and Arabs, if we do not really speak out and fight this fight, then we can't expect, like, I think that there are great allies, and I think that there are people who are fighting this fight in a wonderful way. But I think that you know, people who are getting impacted on a level at home also need to be incredibly vocal and far more so. So yeah, I think it's really just continuing to make our voices heard.
Thank you.
Can I jump in here with a recommendation? Yeah,
please.
Before we move on to the next question, one point that I really, really want to stress, and I alluded to it at the very beginning, is the illegality of this. And no matter what side you think you're on, or it should never be about sides when it comes to humanity, right? And one thing the American people need to understand is that this is an illegal policy. And I encourage everyone that's on the call to Google these laws yourself. You don't have to be a diplomat to understand these laws. It's the Leahy vetting law. It's the Arms Export Control Act. It's the Foreign Assistance Act. These are just a few of the laws that govern our arms transfers to foreign countries. And they stipulate, for one, any human rights abuses, you cannot send arms to that particular unit, to that particular army and military. If a country is blocking humanitarian assistance, you cannot send arms to that country. We, the United States at the moment, and this administration, is in violation of US law. You may have heard of a woman from the State Department named Stacey Gilbert, who herself resigned. She was one of the subject matter experts on the National Security Memorandum, explaining, one of the many subject matter experts, explaining that Israel was in violation of basically the Foreign Assistance Act because it was blocking humanitarian assistance. This is not an opinion. This is fact, and it's documented fact by our experts. But at the political level, they changed the subject matter experts' words. It's a lie. It is a cover-up. It is supposedly un-American. And every American, no matter what the affiliation is, no matter what anything, should be outraged that we're in violation of the law. So what I would urge every caller, everyone that's signed on, every American, is demand enforcement of our laws. And that will really, really alleviate what's happening, because we have systems in place to ensure a situation like this doesn't happen. We are not using them right now as the U.S. government.
What you just heard was a recording of an event the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, the largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization in the United States, held on August 28, 2024, titled Muslim Resignees Speak, How Islamophobia and Anti-Palestinian Racism Fuel Biden Administration's Gaza Policy. To watch the entire event, including additional questions and answers, visit www.care.com. That's CAIR.com. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth. It's long and much bigger. It's long and much nicked. It's long and a dog's claw. Was it hard to so shit? Oh, yes, it is.
Radio Lora, 7.5 MHz. Thank you.